Good evening. Hello. Welcome to the program launch of the 2015 Emerging Writers Festival. I'd like to start by respectfully acknowledging that we are meeting today on the traditional land of the Kulin Nations and pay my respects to their elders past and present and the elders from other communities who may be here today. I'm Sam Twyford-Moore. I'm the director of the Emerging Writers Festival, and I've been eagerly anticipating this night for a while now, busting to share with you this powerful little program. The Emerging Writers Festival continues to go from strength to strength, growing each year to represent more and more writers, and that always makes for a stellar program to hand out. For the team at EWF, it's always an exciting prospect to curate and program new writers, and this year we're bringing you another great lineup with an extended and amazing team behind us. Beck, Kate, Sarah, Amaryllis, Lauren, Autumn, Else, Adelaide, Eric, Izzy, Zoe, Fiona and Tash. We're brimming with new ideas. It's been incredible to see the team grow and to be around a group of people who are so passionate about emerging writers and this festival. And what a festival it will be. Highlights include Writing While Female, a day dedicated to women in the literary arts. Going hand in hand with this is the return of Amazing Babes, the smash hit from last year's festival, with a brand new lineup of incredible writers speaking about the women who have inspired them. Our new performance event, Selfies, sees some of our favourite writers turning the camera on themselves. And we're incredibly proud to be celebrating with our neighbours at Express Media to bring you the 100th issue of Voiceworks. And we will be transplanting an entire office from Sydney to Melbourne for one day only, giving you the opportunity to see behind the scenes at one of Australia's most successful publishing houses, thanks to our partners at Hachette. From morning to night, we have you covered, starting with inspiring breakfast events and partying late into the night with a wonderful, vibrant group of literary magazines at our favourite festival hub, the ever-generous Thousand Pound Bend. This festival will not only provide you with opportunities to develop your skills with masterclasses and professional development workshops, it will also offer a space for you to meet and celebrate with your fellow writers, editors, and storytellers. That we can achieve this is largely down to the support of our incredible partners. We would not be here tonight were it not for the ongoing support of Creative Victoria, the Australia Council for the Arts, the City of Melbourne, the Lord Mayor's Charitable Foundation, and an incredible thank you must go to Monash, our education partner. EWF is incredibly lucky to have a long list of supporters, including the emerging writers in this country that we value and who we do what we do for. We can't wait to celebrate with our community of writers come May. And now we're going to do what the festival does best and introduce you to four talented new and emerging writers. Please join me in welcoming to the stage Oscar Schwartz, Jessica Yu, Chris Somerville and Amy Middleton. So tonight we're playing a game of accepted versus rejected. Every writer has a rejection story. J.K. Rowling was famously rejected 12 times. One publisher suggested that Lolita be buried under a stone for 1,000 years. This little piece of advice from an editor: we feel that we don't know the central character well enough. That was a short-sighted editor to J.D. Salinger about Holden Caulfield. And first we must ask, does it have to be about a whale? I'll let you figure out which book that numbskull editor was talking about. Being rejected is part of the life of a writer, and we have four brave souls here to share their battle wounds with you tonight. These four writers will present two pieces of writing, one that's been accepted and one that's been rejected. It's up to you to guess which one made the cut. We'll ask for your very loud applause when they've finished to find out. And don't worry about hurting anyone's feelings. They've already been rejected once before. So first we have Oscar Schwartz, who is a writer from Melbourne. He is interested in the intersections between digital technology and literature. And Oscar recently won the wonderful Lift a Brow Prize for experimental nonfiction. Please welcome Oscar.
Definitely don't worry about insulting, because I've been rejected much more than once, particularly on these pieces. So both of these pieces were written at a time when I was really interested in exploring the relationship between the internet and desire. It was a few years back, and I wrote them both at in a very specific time period, and one was accepted and one was rejected, and I was kind of confused as to why that was the case. So I'll begin with the first one. I remember the first time I heard someone say the word internet. I was sitting in the back seat of my parents' car on a long drive back from the Melbourne airport, listening to my mum tell my dad that she had spent 2 hours surfing the net in an airport in America. It was 1995 and I was 7 years old. I listened vaguely to my mum explain how the net worked, and it seemed to me like a new activity or an adventure sport. I felt a curious admiration for my mum, as if she had been somehow inside a computer, surfing a digital blue wave with the futuristic, dimly pixelated American people. I remember when we first got the internet at home, my parents knew more about it than me and my sisters. They had to teach us how to use the dial-up modem, how to make passwords and usernames, and how to make emails. I remember it didn't take long, though, before I was spending a lot more time on the internet than my parents. I remember the sound of the dial-up modems and how it made me feel. I remember humming along with the dial-up modem as it connected me. I remember the first chat site I ever went on. You had to choose an avatar. You walked around this virtual world. Everything was blue. I remember when my parents told me to be careful surfing the net. I remember the first time someone on a chat group asked me ASL. I told them I didn't know what that meant. They said age, sex, location. I freaked out because they said the word sex. I figured that's what my parents were warning me about and logged off. I felt guilty for days afterwards. I remember, get off the phone, I need to use the internet. I don't remember my first Hotmail address. I remember my good friend's email address was cheese_hamburger@hotmail.com. I thought it was hilarious. I remember when passwords didn't have to include numerals and could be as short as you wanted. I remember when pictures used to load slowly from the top of the screen to the bottom. I remember the first porn I ever looked at. I was with my friend at his house and his sister was there. I remember when it was cool to say .com at the end of a sentence. For example, if I said something stupid or obvious, someone might say in response, "You're an idiot.com." I remember printing off pages off the internet on that old printing paper that was stuck together in one continuous fold. I remember the first school project I used the internet for. It was about fur seals. I remember when people had home pages. I didn't have a home page, but my cousin did. It was black in colour and dedicated to Green Day. I remember Napster. I remember the feeling of having access to any music I wanted. I remember how important mailing lists were on Hotmail. I remember chain mail on Hotmail. I remember those emails that ended, "If you don't send this to 10 people, something terrible will happen to you." I remember not being able to read to the end of those emails because they were genuinely scary. I remember thinking that the internet was a CD-ROM. I remember my sister's first nickname on MIRC. It was Girl with three R's. I thought it was really cool. I remember my first nickname on MIRC. It was Tiger 23. My sister told me it was lame. I remember my cousin taking me to a cyber cafe on Saturday night. I had to sit and watch him play Counter-Strike, then we went to KFC. I remember John slaps Jim around with a large trout. I remember sharing one computer with my whole family. I remember, don't look at my screen, it's private. I remember TTYL. I remember there was one boy at school called Robert who was good with computers and created proxies that bypassed the school security. I remember not knowing what proxies meant. I remember online games. I remember the first thing I sold on eBay, it was a guitar. I remember the first thing I bought on eBay, it was a skateboard. I remember the first idea I had for a website, it was terrible. I remember having to literally type in the whole URL, including http://. I remember worrying that the girl I liked had blocked me on MSN. I remember worrying about how many X's to write a girl on her birthday. I think I ended up doing 3XXX and regretting it. I remember with people I didn't want to chat to anymore, okay GTG or okay BRB. I remember when people became girlfriend and boyfriend in real life and would change their MSN nickname to John Loves Jill or whatever. I remember when my crush at the time wrote BRB, I would literally sit there and wait for her until she came back. I remember spinning around on my swivel chair while I waited for her to respond to my messages on MSN. I remember that adults talked about the internet and how amazing it was all the time. And I also remember people my age didn't talk about the internet at all. We just kind of used it. So that's the first one. So the second one is a little bit different, a little bit more contemporary. I'm not going to give any background other than to say that Omegle, which is something I mentioned a few times, is a video chat site like Chatroulette. So a video chat site is where you turn on your webcam and you're partnered at random with someone else who's using it anywhere else in the world, and it is notorious for people showing their dicks. A girl, around 18, sitting alone in a very dark room. All I can see is her face lit up by the screen. She's wearing heavy purple eye makeup. She smiles nervously. You're now chatting with a random stranger. Say hi. Stranger. Hi. Me. Hi. How are you? Stranger. Good, I guess. You? Me. Pretty good. Stranger. Where are you from? Me. Australia, but I'm in New York. Stranger. I'm in Georgia. Lol. Me. Do you use Omegle often? Stranger. Yeah, there is too many penises. I look for the guys that don't offer to show do not want to see boobs. I just like clean convos. Me. Do most guys want, like, sexual things on here? Stranger. Yes. Frown face. Me. All guys? Stranger. 98%. Me. Why do you think that's what they want? Stranger. Because most males are perverts. Lol. It's the typical male thing. But some guys are nice and do not ask. Lol. Me. Can you tell me all the different types of people you meet? Stranger. Funny, jerks, and sexual. Lol. And there's people that like to be fun, who dance a lot and sing, and people that come on here wanting to show people their talent to get followers on YouTube. Me. If you had to judge the world's population of guys based on this site, how would you describe them in 1 to 5 words? Stranger. Perverted assholes. Lol. Stranger is disconnected. A young guy, probably around 17. He has shaved head. He is topless and a little bit overweight, but only in a puppy fat kind of way. He's sitting at his desk in his room. He looks happy and a little bit arrogant. You're now chatting with a random stranger. Say hi. Me. Hi. Stranger. Sup. Me. You use this thing offered? Stranger. When I'm bored, usually after I'm done with a late night shift. Me. Is it good? Stranger. It's all right. A lot of pervs. But I like talking to the girls, mainly on this because my friend and I are attempting to make 300 girlfriends off Omegle before the end of the summer, a little competition we have. Me. So how does the competition work? Stranger. Well, we talk to the girls and we get to know them. Then we ask if they have Snapchat. We give them our users and they Snapchat us. Some of the chicks on here are hella thirsty. Me. What are your success rates so far? Stranger. I'm at about 100 girlfriends, plus I make them laugh. What are your tactics? Me. What are your tactics? Stranger. Got to be smooth, funny, plus I'm good looking. Me. What'd you do it for? Stranger. We get some girls to take their shirts off or flash us. Ha ha. Stranger. Because we're trying to reach 300 girlfriends, remember? Me. So it's like a numbers game. Stranger. Yeah, one time there were 5 girls in 1 camera, all took their shirts off. They had abs. I don't even have abs yet. Anyways, I got some hunting to do. Later. Stranger is disconnected. A good-looking guy, probably around 24, lying on his bed. He's naked, but I can only see from his waist up. He's resting the computer over his legs and has his head propped up on a pillow. He also has a goofy smile. You're now chatting with a random stranger. Say hi. Me. Hi. Stranger. Hey. Me. Question. Do you use this instead of porn? Stranger. Yep. Me. Why? Stranger. LMAO. Seriously? Because porn is too fake. Smiley face. Not all the time, but most of the time. Me. So this is better because it's more real? Stranger. Yeah, it's fun because you get to interact with another real person. Me. Do you use it with guys or girls or both? Stranger. Depends. Preferably girls, but if I'm really bored, guys too, I guess. Plus, girls are much harder to find on a site like this. Me. Have you ever had luck with a girl? Stranger. Yes, a couple of times, but it's rare because even though you encounter a girl, half the time they'll skip you. And usually the girl ends up leaving before I finish. Girls aren't as outgoing as us men. Smiley face. And what about the guys? Well, almost every dude on this site is in to have fun, so it's a lot easier, smiley face. Me, so you wait a while for a girl. If no girl, you find a guy you like. Stranger, yeah, pretty much. Me, and after you do what you do, do you just log off, or do you keep chatting? Stranger, usually I just log off. Keep in mind that you'll never see this person again, so it doesn't really matter, smiley face. You don't have to feel bad for ditching the other person, LMAO. Me, do you have a girlfriend? Stranger, yeah. Me, do you think it's cheating? Stranger, I wouldn't consider it cheating because for me it's the equivalent of watching porn. It's not like I'm making any contact with another person or whatever. I don't care about them. They're not real, so it doesn't matter. Me, but you said that it's not like watching porn, that it's more real than that at the start of our conversation, that you like using this site because you like connecting with other people. Hello? Are you there? Stranger is Disconnected. Thank you.
Okay, so you get to play editor now, and you get to accept one of the pieces or reject them or decide which one was accepted. Piece number one, was that the accepted piece that ended up in a published journal? Number two, which one was it? Number two, you're all right. Hey, well done. When we started thinking about this event, we realized some people may have actually read the pieces that were accepted. We didn't quite think that out, but... Jessica Yu is founding editor of the interactive narrativity website Better Narratives. If you haven't seen it, it's absolutely incredible. Her fiction, poetry and nonfiction have been published in Best Australian Poems 2014, The Lifted Brow, The Meandrin Blog, Kill Your Darling, Seizure, Desktop and more. So plenty of places you could have read her potentially published piece. She's a monthly columnist for Right Now. Please welcome Jessica.
I have two pieces. The first one is some excerpts from a memoir I wrote about my uncle who really loved food. It's called Unofficial Eulogy for My Fat Fat Aku. What do you want to eat? They were always his first words when Mum, myself and our luggage had been crammed into his car. Jess, Aku is asking you, I don't know, curry me, cha kway teow, roti canai. I ate something on the plane. She says she doesn't want to eat, he mutters to himself. Jess, Mum could cram a scolding, an order, and a plea all into that one syllable. Kwe Teo Teng. At the best Kwe Teo Teng shop in Penang Island, Fat Fat Aku sat us at a table under a ceiling fan. He put on his glasses and dragged the red plastic bucket with its teapot filled with hot water and cups towards himself. He poured water into each of the cups and emptied them into the bucket. After several repetitions, he used some paper napkins to dry the crockery. He placed the lid of the teapot sideways at its mouth to signal for some tea. He tweaked out orders when he relayed them to the owner of the shop. Less chili for the small one, more bean sprouts for the big one, not too much oil or salt in any of them. He watched us as we slurped the all shiny broth and slippery noodles, monitoring our reactions. He rated each component critically. You wouldn't say their noodles are too soft, but they're stingy about meat. Their prawns were probably frozen from Thailand. Everything's from Thailand. One bowl each was more than enough. Under my mother's eye, Fat Fat Aku could never take more than what he needed. He would sit in small-lipped silence as she spoke. Your gout, your diabetes, do you think medication is magic? And have you been exercising lately? She would remind him with a kind of anger that is one part love and one part fear. Fat Fat Aku was unluckily born at the precise moment when the bottle became available for colicky babies in the kampong. It must have been a relief for my grandma. There is nothing sentimental about breastfeeding in the kind of climate where makeup melts to sugar icing, the kind of climate where no one can be bothered dressing up because they know they will be stripping and wringing the clothes covering their backsides within the next few hours. And also, Ama was the micromanager of a family of eight, owner of a next-door sundry shop and an unofficial rice bowl for rallies of smaller chicken coops. We dare not blame her for shoving a pre-mixed bottle of formula and wood-whip scripe water into Fat Fat Aku's mouth any time he opened it. This is the story of how my Fat Fat Aku stretched his stomach with the self-same pride of a storyteller stretching truth. That's my first excerpt. The second thing I'm going to read is a story called Boy Trouble. It's a piece of fiction about two cousins, and it's told from the perspective of an older cousin. At this point in the story, they've just sort of found out, well, both families have found out that the younger cousin's been sexually harassed by a teacher. I already know, my auntie says. It's past 11 p.m., but auntie and uncle and mum and dad are sitting around the dining table. They're picking at food they don't really feel like. Red pumpkin seed shells lie in piles in front of my mum and uncle. Fried yam balls with sunflower seeds coating the outside and the promise of red bean paste on the inside sweat in their doggy bags. My uncle's picking the sunflower seeds off the yam balls and popping them into his mouth. He used to be one of the top chefs till he gave it up to open restaurants. He still gets a lot of free food. My uncle and dad are silent and very still when I tell them what Rabbit Girl has said. My auntie and mum speak quietly, hoping they won't wake Rabbit Girl up. There's no point. I don't think Rabbit Girl will get much sleep tonight anyway. You knew? Mum asks. I heard her telling her best friend in her bedroom a few days ago. I was about to knock on the door to offer them both some fruit, and I heard the whole conversation. I've been waiting for her to tell me. Mum holds her hand to her forehead like she's taking her own temperature. What are you going to do when she tells you? Cut his penis off, Auntie says. My dad is playing with his phone. He cares so much that he's pretending to be a douchebag so he doesn't let himself go and cry. It still annoys me, though. My uncle is silently stuffing his face with yam balls. The sunflower seeds have all been peeled off, so they don't really make a crunching sound when he bites into them. Seriously, says Mum. I want to talk to him face to face. He has a real evil look, you know. His eyes are like this. My auntie pinches at her eyelid, so only half her eye is open. You can see the tiny red cracks in it if you look up close. And what are you going to say? I don't know. He has a wife and daughter, you know. My daughter told me he was a really good teacher. Always nice is nice to her. I think you should talk to the principal. Oh, I will. I called up my friend who's the principal of a school in Suzhou to get some advice on how to approach him. She asked me if I'd ever come across teachers like that back in my own school days. I told her I hadn't, and she told me she'd met three. Three? Yeah, one was her PE teacher in middle school. When she fell off the balancing bar, he jumped right on top of her. She pushed him off and ran. She got away, but never told anyone. After she graduated, she heard of a girl a few years below who had been raped by him. She can't help but blame herself when she thinks of it. The second and third were university lecturers. They were just crazy, wouldn't take no for an answer. She wasn't raped, but there were other ways to make a woman feel like a girl, I guess. I've never met any teachers, says Mum, but I've been chased on the street at night. You get away, but you don't get to sleep. I feel my facial features go untidy with surprise at this. I don't want her to notice, so I straighten them up in a hurry like I do with the clothing in my wardrobe when I hear Mum's slippers padding up the stairs. Mum's never told me anything like this. I wonder whether she was old or young, married or single, when she was running from shadows on the street with hot, ragged breaths. I tell my own story without thinking. At art school, there was this boy, or man, 4 or 5 years older than me. Chubby, but kind of handsome and intelligent, I thought. He dropped out of all the best art schools in China. He used to ask me if he could give me an orgasm, even after I told him I didn't believe in sex before marriage. He'd say real creepy things like, no orgasms allowed under God, and tell me he was usually the first guy to give most of the girls he slept with an orgasm, like they'd have thought they'd experienced orgasms in the past, and after sleeping with him, they'd say, oh, so that's an orgasm. The women laughed too loudly. I am surprised to hear my shrill laugh mixed in amongst theirs. Then they clap their hands over their lipsticky mouths and wonder aloud if they woke Rabbit Girl up. She has to get up at 5 a.m. to go to school tomorrow, my auntie says to herself. When I leave the table to go to bed, Dad is still swiping his finger across his phone, and Uncle tells me goodnight with yam balls stuck between his teeth. That's my second.
This is a really great event to go. Who rejects anything? This is really great. Okay, was piece one the accepted piece? Piece two. I think that says that you think it's piece two. It was number one. I've actually read that. Yeah, that was a really good piece. Okay, our next writer is Chris Somerville. He is a writer from Queensland who now lives in Melbourne. His first book, a collection of stories, is called We Are Not the Same Anymore. It's fantastic. You should check it out. And here's Chris.
Thank you. So in my early 20s, I was living near Brisbane, not in Brisbane, but I was working in Brisbane, and I got hired by a company that made interactive narratives for movies and TV shows. As an example, before I was hired, the company that hired me did a project for Lost, and the Angelina Jolie vehicle Salt, if anyone saw it. The project I came into was a TV show about teenagers in Brisbane, which was created by someone who hated both teenagers and Brisbane. I just want to say now, I really liked the job, not just because of the people, but it also helped me hone in on a particular kind of self-loathing that I'd been refining since I too had been a teenager. And so the following piece is a scene breakdown for one of the mini episodes to be streamed online. I'd also like to note that the TV show was a comedy and we were encouraged to go pretty bawdy with the humour, and I apologise for that. So this is called Worst Jobs. The four teenager friends help Linda, their other teen friend who is rich and horrible person, pack up her room, stuffing clothes into about a dozen suitcases while Linda, dejected, talks about having to finally go out and join the workforce. Her father has lost all their money. In the background, Luke, the jock one, does a body slam on a suitcase while Tammy, the weird art girl character, struggles to clasp it close. To make Linda feel better, the four friends start to reminisce out loud about their worst job experiences. Brian, a nerd who wears glasses, talks about his job at a bakery and how when he was alone, he put his genitals into the bread dough in the kitchen. It would have been all good if one of the bakers hadn't caught him. When asked why he did this, he explains that he wanted to see himself from a different perspective in order to understand himself better. It's kind of like a metaphor. Back in the hotel room, Luke talks about his worst job, which he says was at a retirement village, emptying bedpans and force-feeding the elderly medication. But then, upon further reflection, it wasn't that bad, and we see him in a flashback, sitting in a recliner, eating retirement village food from a tray and then mercilessly beating a resident at a game of table tennis. Good times, he says, his tiny brain oblivious to the original point of the conversation. Tammy looks at Luke for a second and then talks about her job, which wasn't so bad, but it was just at McDonald's. We see her standing behind the counter looking bored. But she continues, one night her shift manager gave her a lift home, and in the car, he took off both his pants and underpants, and the two of them sit there quietly for a while. Tammy's eyes water. The manager says, I get the feeling this was a mistake, and Tammy quit the next day. Eva, a character who would really later be defined on the actress they cast for the role many months after I was writing this originally, talks about her job at an animal shelter and someone brought in a cat. There's a beat where everyone looks at her. What, she says, a cat killed my grandfather with blood poisoning. And then Linda interrupts to say she feels better. Whatever they've done has worked, and she feels good now. That's part one. So while this show was being made in tandem to this, the company I worked for was hired to write short stories for Brisbane City Transport. And the idea was that you get on a bus and type in the code of the bus that you were on, and that would send that code to a website and you would get a specific story for that bus. So the following story is one I wrote for a bus. It's called 8 Instructions. If it's sunny, close your eyes and look at the sun through your eyelids and try not to think about how each eyelid has veins running through them. If it's not sunny, some other light source can be used instead. Open your eyes. Pretend not to be interested in the people that are climbing onto the bus at each stop. Instead, angle your face towards the window like you're interested in the architecture of the city around you. Wonder why you never studied architecture. Wonder if your last partner left you because you weren't an architect, and if you enrolled in architecture school, if then they'd take you back. Wonder if every action you've taken lately, including arguing with your mother's new boyfriend in the lobby of a cinema and uploading a 1 minute and 30 second video of yourself brushing your teeth onto the internet, are somehow all related to your partner leaving you a month ago. Remember when you were in an earthquake, when you were 8 and on holiday. Remember your father running out of the bedroom, not wearing any clothes, with a look of sheer panic on his face. try to figure out if this has caused a positive or negative effect on your life. Think about how your father once knocked your birthday cake into a swimming pool in your backyard. Think about how you can remember this more clearly than any other birthday from your childhood, even the one where you hyperventilated and passed out beside a dam. If you have a window seat and the bus is starting to get full, do not put your bag on the empty seat next to you. Try to look warm and inviting like a normal person. Smile. Thank you.
I don't want to sway this vote, but that doesn't make me want to get on a bus very much. Okay, so piece one, was that the accepted piece? And then piece two? It was one. Oh, that was kind of even. That was all right.
Sorry.
Yeah. You got to work on your bus enthusiasm, I think. We're very lucky to have the next person because she's an editor, so maybe she can accept all the rejected pieces for her magazine. Amy Middleton is a journalist and writer and also founded the wonderful Archer magazine, Australia's first journal of sexual diversity. I'm not sure if all the pieces will fit in that magazine, but we'll see. Please welcome Amy.
Hey, everyone. I'm going to read out two pieces. I submitted them both to literary journals that are based in Melbourne, so some people in this room will have read them before, possibly both of them if whoever rejected them is in the room. The first one is called On Writing and the Noble Cliché. I wrote it in 2012. Truth, when you go around calling yourself a writer, or you speak at writers' events so everyone else calls you one, your written and verbal expression suffers endless scrutiny. I don't think it's entirely fair. Why are writers expected to be on form 24 hours a day, even when they're slumped in a noisy courtyard after 10 beers on a Saturday night? Bricklayers don't have to showcase their professional skills at the pub, unless, of course, they're building a pub. A writer, on the other hand, at any time of the night or day, runs the eternal risk of being shot down for all manner of language faux pas, for the pure fact that words are supposed to be their thing. Perhaps the most interrogated conversational slip-up is the cliché. That is, an idiom or utterance that has been repeated to the point of saturation, in the driest sense of the word. Now, I've been known to drop the occasional cliché, and my justification is this. Clichés are clichés because of their universal application. They're orally familiar for a reason. It's because they make so much sense. See here, you know someone's in serious trouble if they tell you they're out of the frying pan and into the fire. Your reaction immediately is like, ouch, that must be very uncomfortable. It may be a cliché, but it's a lot more evocative than my current situation is bad and by comparison markedly worse than the previous situation in which I found myself, which was also kind of bad. There are some idioms, though, that are gratuitously violent. I don't understand them. I tend not to use them. For example, there are lots of ways to describe the size of a room without specifying whether or not you could swing a cat in it. There are as many ways, you might say, as there are to skin a cat. In fact, felines in general seem to cop a real flogging in the idiom dictionary. Luckily, they have nine lives and they fall on their feet. Then again, sometimes they get the cream and are allowed to look at kings, so it's not all bad. Working in print media, I've been delighted to find out that journalists love a good cliché. This is particularly true in the area of men's and lifestyle, which is the sector I've spent most of my career in. In this context, certain clichés are seen as harking back to the lost and rarely missed days of the larrikin. For example, if something has been around for a long time, a larrikin might say that it's as old as God's dog. If a larrikin eats too much, for instance, he or she might say they are full as a fat lady's sock or full as a bull's bum. These phrases have moved beyond comedy. The listener isn't even expected to react, except to remember fondly their grandfather's penchant for repetition and his hacky laugh that was all the more expressive if it was at his own joke. These days, these utterances simply function as a signpost that we all kind of understand each other, that we might be able to be reminded of the last time we felt as full as a bovine's backside, and hence may relate better to our fellow overeater beyond the simple concept of imbibing one too many chicken drumettes. I do caution, however, that one should use clichés sparingly, because there's only so many times you can refer to yourself as bending over backwards for somebody before people start to question your lifestyle choices. Thank you. That was the first one. The second one, I'm just going to ask you to note the incredibly dramatic language given the subject matter. It's called Miley Cyrus is good for your brain. I get a lot of backlash when I say I like Miley Cyrus. Maybe like isn't the right word. I'm fascinated. I can't look away. Let's be honest, I love her songs. But then on a cultural level, she's something else. Like a carnival mirror that exaggerates society's flaws and depravities in a spectacular explosion that is easy to watch but impossible to stomach. It's dramatic, right? The wrecking ball clip is my favourite. It's a perfect little slice of evidence for cultural analysis. It starts in the heart for me. The lyrics and the melody, the angst, the vulnerability all tear my emotions in different directions. Pity, alarm, empathy. I never meant to start a war. I just wanted you to let me in. You assume she's talking to a bloke, but she might as well be talking to the entire patriarchy. There are endless essays on the exploitative music industry and the pornification of its female stars, but let's just set these moral evaluations aside for a moment and look at the basics. It's Miley, that arresting face from the side of the bus. And what's this? She's crying. Her lipstick is all cracked and her mouth is twisted in desperation. The long shot shows her tiny body, compact and breakable. The backdrop is a demolition scene, a bleak concrete crypt, probably about as warm and welcoming as the international music industry. Miley's all-American oversized teeth dominate the close-up shots. Her nudity, her confusing sexual simulation with a hammer, these are the resonant images. The song itself has all the lovable hallmarks of a power ballad. It's light and melodic in the verse, with a crashing chorus that pays the listener in remorse and pain and regret. It's a well-crafted pop song. It was top five in 24 countries. And lyrically, from what we can gather, Miley herself is the wrecking ball. I never hit so hard in love. All I wanted was to break your walls. All you ever did was wreck me. Maybe someone else is the wrecking ball. Either way, this diminutive figure came on too strong and ruined everything for herself. She loved with so much fervor that she's being punished. If I let my brain take over for a moment, these lyrics embody manipulation by a powerful partner. They echo the sentiment of someone being held at bay, their unconditional needs used viciously against them to bind and control. Forget pop music, it's the perfect analogy for Western society. As girls, we are raised by this patriarchy to believe that we need it, that we won't survive without it. The father figure of our world holds us at arm's length, forever requesting that we perform for it, that we exist under its gaze, and if we don't abide, we'll be cast out in the cold. Arguably just as Miley would be if she refused to embrace the sex-sodden stardom that is expected of every female artist. As I watch Miley, I feel sad. Sad for myself, for my upbringing, for the girls before and after me. I don't really feel sad for Miley. I feel a maternal instinct, and oddly like buying a T-shirt and a vinyl and a lunchbox bearing her face in solidarity or just to decorate my bedroom. And yes, cultural analysis is my thinly veiled excuse to watch Miley Cyrus videos during work hours, but I stand by my reasoning. What is popular is always a reflection of what's happening around us, and it's rarely, if ever, a joyous sight.
So Miley Cyrus versus the writers. I know which one the Emerging Writers Festival would prefer to have published, but... Yeah, Miley. Yeah, no. So piece one. Piece two. It was piece two. Miley always wins over the writers, but she won't at the Emerging Writers Festival. Please join me in thanking our four brilliant speakers tonight. Uh, Tickets are now on sale for Emerging Writers Festival events. Free events have bookings open, so visit emergingwritersfestival.org.au to book in. Grab a beautiful program on the way out if you don't already have you. A big thank you to the Wheeler Centre for once again hosting our program launch. We love being in this building and thank you warmly for your support. And before you go, we are very aware that writers often have limited expendable incomes and we are proud to offer over 50% of our programs as free events. And for the ticketed events, we work as hard as we can to make sure that we keep prices low. But if you're interested, and if you are able, we would urge you to consider becoming a part of our philanthropic network of pen pals. A $100 donation will go directly towards supporting the artist fee of an emerging writer at the festival, and you can help us to continue programming today's best new writers and enable unheard voices to be discovered. That would be great. That's also on the Emerging Writers Festival website. Thank you to the EWF staff and the wonderful board. You should all feel incredibly proud. You've made this program what it is and will make the festival the incredible experience it will be. Now enough. There are drinks up the back, I think. There's some time to mingle and network with your fellow writers, which is what the Emerging Writers Festival does best. And then we'll all be heading down to our wonderful festival hub, Thousand Pound Bend, from here, and give it a good test drive ahead of the festival. So thank you and good night.